is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine conflict. The headline from London via Rome. Russian missile strike destroys NATO-supplied howitzers in Ukraine. Subhead, urgent need, quote, to speed up arms supplies as defenders, the Kyiv forces, face, quote, critical situation from Kremlin bombardment. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, the United States Army retired, CBS News, Dickinson College. He is the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. For some weeks, we've been characterizing an artillery war. Well, it's upon us. Jeff, a very good evening to you. Striking at the howitzers, and there's an overwhelming photograph in the London papers of a 155-millimeter M77 howitzer that looks to be tracked, so it's mobile. The Russians are said to be preponderant in an artillery war. Is that correct? Good evening to you, Jeff.
Good evening to you, John. That is absolutely correct, without question. The Russians have placed heavy dependence on artillery as part of their military doctrine from the very onset. And again, if you think about this war in Russian military doctrine, which is a derivative of Soviet military doctrine, it stresses two things, speed and mass. Russians tried to accomplish speed early on, seize Kyiv, perhaps seize Kharkiv. Both those failed. A few weeks ago, John, we envisioned a Russian armor advance in the Donbas region, which has never really materialized in large numbers. So since speed has not worked for them, they are now depending on mass. Mass translates in for them. Heavy, intense artillery fire. Don't forget, Joseph Stalin once said, quantity has a quality all its own. And I have seen some reports that on a daily basis, the Russians may be firing up to 60,000 rounds of artillery at targets in Ukraine, largely concentrated down there in the Donbas region. In response, the Ukrainians are only able to muster about 6,000 rounds. So as this becomes more and more an artillery war, that predominance of platforms, predominance of ammunition, and the associated doctrine, unfortunately, favors the Russians.
A headline earlier in the week from the Wall Street Journal, Dateline Europe, Russia exploits artillery advantage as Ukraine braces for attacks on more eastern cities. This is Severodonetsk, and we're given fog of war to understand that Russia has destroyed bridges that would allow an evacuation from Severodonetsk by the besieged forces. Again, this is urban fighting. Does that favor artillery, urban fighting, Jeff?
It may to a degree. The defenders have an advantage because, of course, it channelizes forces in older cities in Europe like this that often are narrow streets. Defenders can use buildings, shoot down on locations. And so in terms of attrition, Ukrainians are claiming that they're inflicting heavy losses on the Russians as they advance. On the other hand, because of Russian emphasis on artillery, you know, artillery is often described as an area fire weapon as opposed to a precision fire weapon. And we often talked about so-called unobserved fire. What is unobserved fire? Well, if I'm destroying a city, I don't need an observer out there. As long as I can know where the city is, I can just pick up the locations and pound away at it. I know where a bridge is. A bridge doesn't move. I can keep pounding that location until I, in fact, destroy it or pulverize it. If I'm trying to hit a target, though, an artillery piece, a tank, a formation, a command post, those are mobile, and I'll need to put observers on that to ensure the accuracy of my fire. So as the Russians in these attacks on cities can depend on the stationary nature, their willingness to just pulverize the cities writ large, they can depend on massive fire and unobserved fire, which does give them certain advantages.
There are two pictures now emerging from the reports that we get from the battlefront. The first picture we've talked about, the Russian advance into Donbass and are dominating the oblasts of Donetsk and Luhansk, these republics, and Kherson in the entryway to Crimea. The second picture is presented by the president of Ukraine in remarks most recently by a video link to the Czech parliament. He quotes, Russia is not interested only in our Mariupol, Severodonetsk, Kharkiv, and Kyiv. No, its ambitions are directed on a vast area from Warsaw to Sofia. Jeff, he's talking about a general advance by the Russian forces after they finish with Kyiv on other parts of the region. Do you see evidence of that in the Russian ability to supply and sustain a conflict?
In the short term, I do not. I do not believe the Russians have the capability to do that in the near term, that being defined perhaps next year or two. They've suffered upwards, in some cases, estimates of 30,000 killed in action, perhaps 60,000 more who are casualties. So they've suffered 100,000 casualties, which is a huge number. And so far, at least, Vladimir Putin has not mobilized, nor has he declared war, which would allow him to draw on reserves. So I don't believe they have the manpower or the materiel. They've lost 1,000 tanks. That certainly is Mr. Putin's aspiration, which is to secure all of Russia. Medvedev, who was former president the other day, talked about Ukraine actually disappearing over the next couple of years, suggesting taking full control. And we saw that, what I thought, John, rather bizarre speech this week by Mr. Putin comparing himself to Peter the Great and how he needed to reassure those particular territories that Peter the Great actually controlled for Russia. Well, anybody that looks at their history quickly would know that encompasses large portions of the Baltic region, portions of Finland, Sweden, and even some of the Eastern European countries. So if he's decided, describing himself in those terms and describing those aspirations, that certainly could suggest to us that they have far greater desire to expand territory for Russia than simply controlling the Donbas region of Ukraine.
The artillery battle captain that you are, Jeff, you guide me to learn about what is what the artillery is capable of from the U.S., these weapon systems that are being shipped to Ukraine. However, you guide me to a kind of ammunition called M1156 Precision Guidance Kit. What is that?
Well, that, John, is basically a fuse that you'd put on an artillery shell, any high explosive artillery shell, and by doing so, it becomes a smart munition. You actually enter the grid coordinates for the target in the fuse, and if that particular round is launched and it can get into an area of roughly 8 by 8 kilometers, then that fuse will actually guide the projectile right to the target. A more advanced version of that is an entire round called an Excalibur that the U.S. has. It's unclear to me, however, John, whether or not we have provided the Ukrainians with significant numbers of Excalibur or even any of these particular fuses, because they are in somewhat limited supply, I would imagine, in U.S. wartime stocks. And there would also be a concern, I'm sure, in the U.S. military that these particular weapons, fuses, if they were ever captured by the Russians, a Ukrainian unit overrun, for example, the Russians could exploit, re-engineer that to their own advantages vis-a-vis future conflicts that might involve the United States.
So right now we have fog of war, an artillery battle that favors the Russians because of mass, and the Ukrainians are asking for more and better ammunition, or just more of everything, Jeff?
They're asking for more of everything, I think, particularly platforms. Zelensky said something about having enough ammunition. I'm somewhat concerned about that, because if their expenditure rate is 6,000 rounds a day, we might pat ourselves on the back by saying the United States just gave them over 200,000 artillery rounds. That's only 30 days of supply. It's days of supply of ammo that's key, and that's how you calculate it in war, not total number of rounds. So he's talking more about platforms, needing hundreds of more platforms, artillery, air defense weapons. And so far, at least, the Ukrainians are complaining a good deal that pledges are not necessarily equaling rapid delivery. And one of the countries they pointed to, of course, is the Germans, who a number of weeks ago pledged to deliver 7 new howitzers. Best of my knowledge, those howitzers have yet to be delivered. The Germans pledged to provide a tracked air defense vehicle, an older weapon system, but it could be useful. Those have yet to be delivered. Now, as we're talking, John, the consultative group the United States has established of 40 countries to coordinate resupply for the Ukrainians is meeting. And I'm sure that's going to be an urgent question on the table of how we accelerate and expand the amount of ammunition and platforms we're delivering. And then subsequently this week, defense ministers will meet in Brussels. And then later next week, of course, we're going to have a NATO summit involving Mr. Biden. All of these questions of more and accelerating delivery of training and weapons to the Ukrainians will be part and parcel of those discussions.
Jeff and I are talking about a battlefield right now in Europe that is an ongoing fog of war situation. However, at the end of this month, just about the same time NATO will be meeting in Madrid, the Colonel and I are going to spend time talking about a battle that took place in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, near where the Colonel is right now. And the battle was the 3 days of Gettysburg. The first day, is the important one to my reading, because that was the moment when decisions were made by the Confederate forces not to overwhelm the outnumbered and outpositioned Union forces. The situation is this. Buford, his cavalry unit, runs a ragged and falling back position as the heavy infantry of the Confederates come on from the east of Gettysburg. They send quickly for the Union Army to come up, and the first arriving is the First Corps, led by a general named Reynolds, whom everybody enjoyed and celebrated. He was killed in action, however. And the 11th Corps came up. And Jeff, I turn to you. Is this the moment with the 11th Corps up behind Howard and the remains of the First Corps, is this the moment when the Confederates could have overwhelmed the Union forces?
It's very possible, because Richard Ewell arrives from the north with the 2nd Confederate Corps, drives the Yankees back. The line breaks around Seminary Ridge, and the Yankees flee through the town up onto Cemetery Hill and to Culp's Hill. That moment, of course, Robert E. Lee, who's arrived on the field, sends a message to Richard Ewell, that most recently arrived Corps commander, saying to him a famous line, if you study Gettysburg, take that hill to your front if you deem it practicable, a very 19th century word. Richard Ewell hesitates late in the afternoon. His men are in the town. They are disordered, and he doesn't want to fight at night. And the Confederates do not advance. And many people point to that as the moment that if they had pushed ahead, they would have driven the Yankees off of Cemetery Hill, Culp's Hill, Cemetery Ridge. It would have been a one-day battle and a Confederate victory. And then you can spin American history anywhere you want to in the aftermath.
Jeff and I will discuss all 3 days of the Battle of Gettysburg on June 30th. Right now, we're going to turn to NATO's confrontation with Moscow. I'm John Batchelor.